We have our guest, Mr. Steve Moore from State Water Board. And if you could give us your report, Mr. Moore. Thank you.
Well, pleasant good morning to you. I'm Stephen Moore, board member on the State Water Resources Control Board and liaison to the Central Coast region. And it's my pleasure to be here and give you a little update on our activities. And certainly want to start by welcoming board member Jane Gray, and thank you for stepping up to do this voluntary position and of great assistance and import to us at the statewide level. And we can't say enough about how much we appreciate everybody's service here. And it's great to hear your reports this morning. Today, I don't know if you all pay attention to this, sort of the Sacramento goings-on. You may have heard about the, it's referred to as Cal Water Fix. It was formerly known as Bay Delta Conservation Plan. And so today is the first hearing on the what is informally known as the Twin Tunnels under the Delta. It's actually a pre-hearing, so I'm not playing hooky in San Luis Obispo. We have two hearing officers for what is a petition from the two water projects, the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project, to change the point of diversion from the Delta for those two major projects. And so it's a water rights hearing. And so today and tomorrow there are discussions about the procedural issues with that water rights change petition. And the actual hearings begin April 7th. And we have our calendars booked solid through July to conduct these hearings on water rights. So that will take a lot of our time. And I apologize for not being here for November meeting. I was actually at the North Coast Water Board meeting that day. But and they're having a meeting today, too. You guys are scheduling a lot of your meetings at the same time, so I've got to come up with a plan this year. But I'll do my best to be here to hear about your updates, hear from staff, and also share what's going on at Sacramento. This year, we're trying something kind of new. You know, my hope, as you know, I served on the San Francisco Water Board, San Francisco Bay Water Board, and also was staff there many years back. And so it's been a real high interest to me as a state board member to enhance our coordination between state board and regional boards. Perhaps more important to me than maybe all of the other state board members. So in taking that role seriously, I've been engaged more with our monthly chairs calls, and Jean-Pierre has been participating in that lately, and Mr. Young was involved before. And we're trying to build in a little more input from the board member level in terms of our priorities and dealing with budgets, budget issues, staffing issues, and that sort of thing, just to make sure we're all plugged in together. And so as you get the flavor, you know, of board member roles, you get to choose kind of your level of involvement, frankly. And to the extent that the regional board members are interested in these issues, I'm hoping to, you know, engage those who really want to dig into the details as much as possible. So in that spirit, we're having our first three-hour chairs call. They're usually an hour, and everybody kind of goes around and talks about issues. We're actually going to drill down into the budget and the budgeting process and the way we allocate resources in the state and regional water boards. And we're going to take 3 hours on Monday to really get into it. And we've tried to make this open but manageable. So if, and we think that having the EOs involved is great. You know, we just started this process off this week with what's known as the MCC, the Management Coordinating Committee, which is all the executive officers of the regional boards going through the same information. And just to make sure we're all on the same page, this week's call will, you know, have the option of having the EO present so that we're all speaking the same language and are up to date. So I think it'll be a great co-learning experience for everyone to get as deep into the details or not as you wish. But there are some highlights, you know, that, and our executive director, Tom Howard, is really getting taking advantage of the opportunities with the legislatures and the administration's attention to water issues to really use this moment in history to take best advantage we can to get the resources we need. It's a bit of art involved, you know, in terms of hitting the right optimal amount. We can't ask for too much, or we'll get a lot of strong pushback from folks like Department of Finance. And so Tom has been successful. In the last 2 or 3 years, we've really built programs up and used things like the 401, the wetlands permitting program. It went under an audit. It was kind of, frankly, under attack. And the audit resulted in a good transparent review of the program. And we ended up adding 11 or 12 staff that show, you know, because of specific needs of the program to track and be responsive in a customer service type way. So these, we welcome the sunshine to our programs because we often can make a case for getting additional resources. So along those lines, as you can tell, the theme of my talk today will be more about budget. Just a few little facts on the proposed budget, because in January the governor around the 10th of January each year, the governor proposes a budget. And it's largely confidential leading up to that point. The governor's budget for 16-17 provides $1 billion, with a B, and 2,107 positions for the state and regional water boards. And we used to be more like 1,700, and then we had the Division of Drinking Water added in 2014. A few highlights. I have many pages here, and I won't go over everything, but there was with the Safe Drinking Water account, we added 2.5 positions to deal with workload associated with consolidating public water systems to address safe drinking water issues, especially for disadvantaged communities, and to conduct outreach to domestic well owners and conduct public meetings and hearings that are part of the SB 88 legislation from last June that gave us the authority to consolidate public water systems to address disadvantaged community issues. And that's going to be in Drinking Water Division. There were some temporary limited term positions in the timber harvesting program. I know it doesn't affect this region largely, but there's a little work here. Those are going to become permanent positions. An important legislation that I've mentioned to you before was the SB 445, site cleanup sub-account implementation. This is dealing with some of our orphan underground tank sites, a new tool we have to address longstanding contamination issues throughout the state. We received an increase of $2.4 million in the Water Quality Control Fund cleanup and abatement account, and 17 staff positions throughout the state. And we actually benefited from regional board management input in making the case to get this into the governor's budget. Again, it's not set in stone. The budget gets adopted in June, but this is the governor's proposal at this time. Some other aspects, the swamp program has had to transition from a contracting program to an in-house program for a lot of complicated reasons. It's been a very difficult transition for folks, but at this point we're at 6 permanent positions to be funded from a shift in that contract authority from the Waste Discharge Permit Fund. And so that will provide field sample collection, processing, data entry, and data management services to the regional water boards. So this is an ongoing team effort, trying to work through transition from a successful contracted program into more of an in-house program to meet union requirements and state laws. They're not required, union needs and state laws. And I know that affected this region and as well as others. A lot of in the news these days is water efficiency in the face of the drought. We received a position to assist with assist water suppliers with water loss audit work. So we have a full-time position to help make that happen with the report validation assistance for urban retail water suppliers. You may have heard of AB 401, which is the Low Income Water Rate Assistance Program for disadvantaged communities. We received a position to work on what will be culminating into a submittal of a report to the legislature on low income water rates assistance. So there are many things. There's a Lake Tahoe issue. There's $21.4 million in drought assistance for both temporary and permanent solutions for drinking water. So there's a whole list of different pots of money and positions that have been put in this year's budget that really do, and water rights, 17 positions to deal with the whole measuring and reporting of diversions, going out and getting the licenses issued in a more timely manner. These are things we've been asking for years, and the water rights side, and we're finally getting traction, which is good news. So that means we have the attention of the governor, the attention of the legislature to these issues that have been longstanding. So it's an opportunity. And that I kind of circle back to, you know, bringing in the board members and executive management of the regions into this dialogue to make sure we're not missing anything. And if anything, maybe we can come up with a couple of goals for this year, because this is the time of the year where you start formulating budget change proposals that would affect next year's budget. And God willing, we'll still have this governor in place, and he'll still have his ear toward water issues. I guess the most important thing is in the proposed budget is to have trailer bill language to improve the recruitment and retention of regional water quality control board members and fairly compensate regional water board members for their time. So the proposal is to increase the per diem from $100 to, drum roll, $500, and establish a pool of $756,000 for purposes of water board member compensation, increasing the annual cap of $13,500 in per diem allocated to each regional water board to reflect the proposed increase in this per diem. So it's now in the proposal stage. I guess we don't hold our breath really, but you know, it's nice to see it there. And a lot of people worked hard to get it there. So those are some highlights on the budget. You probably have a lot more questions, but I wanted to let you know about this process that we're gonna try out this year. We'll have 3 3-hour calls. And we've invited the vice chairs to participate, but we want, if all, at all possible, to have everyone from one region in the same room, and then you can put the mute button on and talk about things amongst yourselves. And then the 9-region conference call doesn't get too chaotic. So we were trying to establish those type of ground rules. Even other interested board members could participate, but hopefully within the same room. So there's a lot of regions, you know, but all are very important. So real briefly, some recent things we're working on. I would like to note that the State Water Board approved issuing a revenue bond this month of $1.2 billion through the SRF program. We've had a lot of cash in reserves in the SRF program. It's federally, you know, the federal grants come in and we keep it going through interest payments and that sort of thing. Our interest rates are low, very competitive, 1.9%. We've done things to improve the program on customer service turnaround, but also we've extended the term of loans to 30 years. And that has brought in a whole lot of interest, as it were. A lot of people want to take advantage of this great tool we have to do infrastructure for clean water and drinking water. So we had a 40% increase in commitments from fiscal year 2014 and 15. And we have this greater demand expected going forward because of these favorable characteristics of the financing program. And plus we have the AAA rating, And so this is a really solid, solidly run program. So we have confidence to issue this revenue bond of $1.2 billion to really enhance this the funding available. And it was driven largely by Sacramento Regional. I don't know if you've heard that whole issue, but they have to go to nitrification, denitrification in that major treatment plant to deal with delta nutrient issues. Well, to fund that basically will deplete our cash reserves. And LA is sitting there with a lot of work to do, city and county of San Francisco. But you know, you need not worry in the Central Coast that we want to take advantage of actually the interest payments that the big guys in the state help churn, prime the pump, if you will, to use an engineering metaphor, to keep this program going. And so that gave us confidence, and to bring this up, this will be a tool to fuel planning and implementation of recycled water projects throughout this region. I know a lot of folks would like to get going, and we're using Prop 1 grant funding to help fuel that too, for the smaller Central Coast communities. It would be nice to get the recycling going. Well, our Division of Financial Assistance really stands ready to do everything we can. There's one simple application. Doesn't matter if you want a loan or a grant. Just send in the simple application and get it started for planning and then implementation of recycled water work, clean water work, drinking water work. So that's good news. Another thing we did this month, we finally adopted the stormwater strategy, something that your staff helped us with tremendously. And this is a large paradigm shift that we've been talking about here, about treating stormwater as a resource as opposed to some kind of a flooding hazard or a pollutant carriage system, but really thinking of it as part of the water supply. And here in this region, your stormwater program is one of the leading edge programs in the state. And so a lot of the wisdom from the efforts here, whether it was the joint effort that we helped fund, that you helped lead, on the science review of low impact development, all of these things have fed into the goals and objectives of our statewide stormwater strategy. And really elevating the importance of restoring watershed processes and creating alternative compliance pathways for cities and adjacent agricultural areas. For a pathway, if you can't meet standards today, and if there's a TMDL in place or one in the works, that through stormwater implementation, we can deem entities in compliance if they're working on a watershed-based plan that leads to meeting water quality standards. And so we're going to, through our stormwater strategy, work at the state board with regional boards to develop clear guidance on these alternative compliance pathways. From a civil engineering standpoint, I'm very excited and supportive of this because this sets the stage for capital improvement plans and O&M that go with it that are based in watersheds and looking at things like stormwater as a utility and an infrastructure that has to be integrated with recycled water, clean water, drinking water, groundwater, et cetera. It's the one water vision. And so the stormwater strategy I would just put forward is the way regional boards and the state board can really substantively participate in advancing one water principles for the next generation of water infrastructure.
Mr. Moore?
Yeah.
Excuse me. Mr. Moore, can I interrupt you for just 1 second? I'd like to recognize Dominic Rock, who's in the room on our staff, who is kind of a leader in stormwater statewide, and everything that Mr. Moore itemized about this strategy, and when he said your staff helped, was largely because of Dominic Rock and his expertise and his outreach and excellent work. Thank you, Dominic.
Yes, I apologize for not mentioning him by name. He deserves all that recognition. And so I'm very excited and so grateful for this region's leadership and assistance moving forward. And I think It's a big part of the California Water Action Plan that you'll hear from the governor's administration, but this is coming through on that. And you know, our Office of Sustainable Solutions, have you heard of that term? I mean, you know, the Water Action Plan, the OS, Office of Sustainable Solutions was set up under statute last year. It basically brought the disadvantaged community, you know, financing programs of drinking water and wastewater under Megan Tosney's leadership and other folks at the state board. And stormwater is part of the deal too. You know, it's, you know, we're looking at ways, because stormwater financing is really tricky, as you know, with Prop 218 and all that. We're working toward trying to solve that through our administration, League of Cities, and others for a ballot this November to change Prop 218 to deal with these issues. Well, because there hasn't been a funding stream, the governance of stormwater throughout the state, especially in low-income communities, has been maybe non-existent, you know. And so, quote, you know, where do we begin? And so this is on our radar screen as part of working with lower-income communities to bring the tools to the table and looking at grant funding through Prop 1 to spur on those multi-objective projects. Thanks to Dr. Hunter for mentioning the Human Right to Water Resolution. We've received international positive feedback on that draft document, and it's pretty exciting, extremely important, and just thank you, you know, for participating and showing leadership on that issue here in this region. We are going to be considering the update of the conservation regulations. That's the 25% mandatory reduction of urban water use that's received a lot of media attention. The reason why we're taking that up on Tuesday is because the regulations are expiring. They were 270-day emergency regs that expire in February. And the governor has been plugged in, and he issued an executive order in November that basically directed us to reissue these regulations if through January drought conditions persist. Well, drought conditions have persisted, and we continue from a statewide level have a severe deficit in water compared to previous, compared to before the drought. And so we remain hopeful, and we're gonna have enough flexibility in our proposal to be able to shift gears if we get an El Nino level of rain. It's pretty clear that we need to continue the momentum that's been built statewide through our citizens really embracing the challenge. So we're proposing some minor changes, but keeping to the need to continue to conserve and emphasizing outdoor, discretionary landscaping, non-essential urban ornamental landscaping is a low-hanging fruit that we were successful in using last year to achieve 1 million acre feet in savings. We achieved enough water savings between June and the end of the year to serve a metropolis of over 6 million people. So it's nothing to shake a stick at. So we've been receiving a lot of input. You know, we had a workshop in December, got 200 letters we had to go through. Got another 200 letters to go through for Tuesday. But we're doing our best to really work cooperatively with the water suppliers who have been extraordinary leaders in our state in getting the word out and working with our citizens to achieve these unprecedented conservation results. I'm sorry for going on and on, but there's just so much going on in this state on water. We are going to, in the next few months, take up some petitions on agricultural discharge permits from the Central Valley Board. And I know you all are interested in that and making sure that that continues, that we address matters brought up in those petitions. So we're having a workshop probably in March, I'm guessing at this point when that's going to get scheduled, but our goal is to resolve that in the August-September timeframe.
Mr. Moore, what is being petitioned?
These are waste discharge requirements for discharges from irrigated lands.
And specifically, what are the issues?
Oh, yeah, I'm not really prepared to give you specific issues, but just to say that, you know, that there's a lot of similar issues that have been brought up here. We can get into more detail. Your staff could brief you.
It's the East San Joaquin Valley order. It's, I think, their first real order that's coming up in front of the board. It should touch on just about every part of agriculture. It's a fairly broad order. Now, it hasn't come out yet. The draft order is going to come out at any time. It is being very thoroughly debated, I believe, because it's been supposedly coming out since Thanksgiving. I think they're going to touch on issues involving the expert panel, nitrates, so it's going to be fairly wide-reaching.
Monitoring requirements?
Yes. And,
okay.
That's right. Thank you very much, Jessica, for filling in the gaps a little bit. Another issue of interest here in this region is the oil and gas monitoring. You might recall we adopted model criteria for groundwater monitoring in oil and gas well stimulation areas last July. And your staff and our staff have been pretty active in this area. I just want to acknowledge that and thank you for your efforts. And there was, you know, a stakeholder meeting in November, and then a second one in January to discuss draft performance measures. We had an all-staff meeting in December with state and regional board coordination. It was held in regional board offices in Fresno. Your staff were there, as well as other regional boards. And we're really holding these meetings to promote a collaborative process in this program and look at site-specific issues and share experience and discuss process and communication in order to develop a more statewide consistent report approach on oil and gas monitoring activities. Issues come up like aquifer exemption, and we're working with your former executive officer, who's now working for Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, or affectionately known as Dogger. They're in the Department of Conservation, by the way, just in case you're interested. We had a joint public hearing with them in September, and we're looking at, and we talked about, I think, in September, that the Arroyo Grande oil field near here, and looking at that as a possible exempt aquifer. And so just want to acknowledge those efforts that are ongoing. You know, I mentioned the Water Action Plan, and it's a framework, really. It's like a promise of this administration to look at water issues in an integrated and in a way that puts things on equal footing, so that, you know, safe water for disadvantaged communities is on the same level as protecting and restoring ecosystems, at the same level of water supply reliability, sustainable groundwater management, conservation, development of local portfolios, water recycling, all that, all on the same level of footing. And so one of the pilots, it's not in this region, but it's adjacent, is in the Ventura River, is actually an effort with Fish and Wildlife and the Water Board and the LA Regional Board to develop flow objectives, water quality objectives that could go in the basin plan or a statewide plan that will be numeric objectives to protect beneficial uses. So that's where you bring in our Water Rights Division, and you look at, you know, integrated water quality and habitat needs for beneficial uses, working with Fish and Wildlife. The governor has said there's going to be 5 river systems, you know, through this Water Action Plan that our agencies are going to work together to come up with public trust flow needs for these rivers. And Ventura River is the Central Coast-ish river that is the pilot. So I would encourage your staff to pay attention to that and look for opportunities to use those principles and those relationships to work on other river systems in this region. It's not the intent to stop with these 5 rivers. I think, you know, it just speaks to sustainable water management in the long haul. There's a vision we're trying to promote, which is that if you want to get the water right system and in balance and that sort of thing, you have to establish what's needed for public trust. and then, you know, through a water master system, adjudicate and allocate uses for human uses, urban, agricultural, et cetera, and have a local water master, and have a monitoring and reporting program, and have local tools and authorities to make sure folks follow the rules and that everyone's treated fairly. This can be accomplished by modifying and adapting the existing water rights system. And as Dr. Hunter pointed out, the power of information is so key. Having good information on quantities of water is going to make the difference, and that's what we did. This last week, we adopted an emergency regulation for SB 88 to require measurement and reporting of water diversions throughout the state for 12,000 water rights holders. Riparian, pre-14 appropriative, post-14 appropriative. And there are deadlines in the regulation we extended through careful stakeholder engagement. We're going to really start this next year, January 1st, 2017. And we've tried to really be careful about adapting the expectations to different tiers, if you will, different levels of diversion, to really respect that this can be costly. But in the end, we all benefit from good information to make better decisions. So that's part of what this administration, this legislature is interested in, really modernizing our water management system. And at the State Water Board, we're humbly but boldly trying to make good on these expectations. And we need all the help we can get from our family in the regions. So thank you very much.
So before having my colleagues ask a further question, just a couple of clarification. In regard to the per diem of board members, the $100 per diem was established 20 years ago. So I just want to put that in the background. The other point I wanted to make is that in our region, we're actually engaging every board member in the budget process. So if you look at the agenda this afternoon, we have carved out the majority of the time for the board to collaboratively discuss the budget and priorities. And this actually came through the first round of prioritization and budget developed by the staff. So that's what we're going to be covering this afternoon. And we will then be taking this consensus from the entire board in the conversation that we will have next week. This approach, by the way, was discussed with Deputy Assistant Chief Counsel and also with Tom Howard, who thought it was an interesting approach of really trying to bring everybody together from the staff to the board. Yes, Mr. Delgado.
All right, thank you very much, Stephen. Stephen, did you mention that there was 2.4 million or billion for this site cleanup SB 445 related funding? I thought you said billion, but it seemed too high.
I think it's a million.
Okay. It wouldn't be billion because that would be stratospheric, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then on our per diem issue, how much do other similar state agency board members get? Coastal Commission, what's the status quo?
I don't know the answer, but it tends to be similar. Sometimes it's no compensation, or maybe it could be just the per diem. Because I'm just going off of the I look at the appointments calendar, and they divulge what the compensation is. So many boards have no compensation, but there's a per diem, a mileage rate type arrangement
okay.
in many places.
And also I can supplement a little bit the information because I was engaged in trying to help, can we revisit the compensation is that it is not, strictly to be looked at in the dollar amount of the compensation, but the amount of work expected from the board. There are certain boards in our state where the actual activity and expectation of the board members tends to be rather minimal. And so there was this quantitative and qualitative evaluation also of a level of activity that is expected from board members in these various boards. And that was one of the elements that was included in the analysis done statewide. The other aspect, too, that had been viewed and recognized by the governor office is that in an indirect or unintended consequence, when you do have a combination of high expectation of participation and time from board members and low compensation, is that we tend to disenfranchise some individuals who literally could not afford being volunteering to boards. And so this was another way of trying to balance a little bit more the enticement to, you know, folks who basically would not be able to afford volunteering. And there has been an effort done by the governors. In fact, there was a meeting held here in San Luis Obispo, I'm going to say about 2.5 months ago, in looking at how can we improve, the governor office can improve bringing, you know, a broader range of volunteers in all the various boards.
So I think it would be nice, it would be helpful for us to know whether or not 500 is fair, too much, too little, whatever, to understand what's the California Department of Fish and Game Commission getting, what's the California Coastal Commission getting, what are other boards getting in the state? And if they're all getting 100, that doesn't make sense, right? If they're all getting 1,000, it's too little. If they're all getting 250, maybe 500 is too high. But, you know, we're not the only ones out there. There's a local waste management district getting help from a local assembly person, Mark Stone, for the same per diem rate that hasn't changed for 20 years. And so that assembly person has looked at existing state law that regards waste districts, so that they're not asking for special legislation for this particular district. They're just bringing that district up to what the legislation allows all waste districts. So if there are similar, if there's similar law for similar agencies, it seems like it would be more fair and logical to know about that. You mentioned a $20,000 figure. Is that true in this case of what this increase would cost per year for this board?
Yeah, it was, there's a current annual cap, $13,500.
And before that, I thought you mentioned a $20,000 figure.
Not in this discussion.
Okay.
And, but that was just sort of, you know, as the chair noted, there's a different level of effort. This region, you have more travel, and you have regional board hearings in different parts of your large region. That's different than Santa Ana, where folks can just commute right to the board meeting from their homes.
Right. Good point.
Or San Francisco, even, where I was working. That's what, you know,
right.
Wasn't
good
as
point.
Much traveling. So this cap was kind of problematic and for some regions like here, Lahontan, Central Valley, where there's a lot of travel. And so this, we're really trying to rectify some of those realities by getting rid of a cap that's sort of arbitrary. And but then having an overall $756,000 pool that we can work together on allocating fairly.
Okay. Just for digestion, every day I'm here, it's a vacation day. So I get 6 weeks vacation from my federal job, and every day I'm here, it's a vacation day. So it's not just a financial issue. It's actually more important that I don't get to go to Tahiti every year like I used to. No, just kidding. Do you find it hard, Steve, or do you think it'll be a tough sell to advise the public that drought continues when public is seeing, you know, is that going to be a hard sell? And is there a decided upon strategy to explain why the drought conditions continue, even though?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a very profound challenge, and I will say we saw it coming. You know, that with unprecedented deficits, you know, I can throw some numbers around. You know, we're 22 million acre feet in deficit between surface 8 million and 14 million in groundwater going into this year. Colorado River is 26 million acre feet in deficit. So we're coming in at incredibly historically low levels of reservoirs and all that other stuff. So, and very dry soils, you know, paleolithically dry. South of the Delta, driest soil conditions, according to UC Davis study, since for 1,200 years. So that was when Charlemagne was just establishing the Carolingian Empire, or whether it's France and Germany now. I mean, so our antecedent conditions, as we say, were so severe. So we were already trying to tell this to the press and all that. And just last week, you know, the Department of Water Resources, they said, we have an average year so far. Average doesn't get you out of a four-year historic drought. You know, and so that's the kind of messaging we're trying to use. And so far it's average. We may get an above average slug of water in the next 2 months, but we'll know a lot more in April 1st.
So some of us sit on other boards and have opportunities to interact with the public. And if there were a set of talking points that smart people have decided are the easiest elevator speech to communicate to the public, it'd be helpful if we were all on the same page with that.
Well, that's a great suggestion, and I know our folk like George Castirico and our public affairs folks help us with the latest drought talking points and that sort of thing. So as my action item, I'll get back to them and get drought talking points, you know, the six bullets that you need. So you can tell your friends and your family. And
put out local press releases. Last question, you mentioned 200 letters and then another 200 letters. And were those people or entities complaining about having to go down the reporting track?
Yeah, you know, the huge bulk of the comments are on the numeric target. You as regional board members and staff, you know that a lot of the discussion and controversial items comes down to that effluent limit or that waste load allocation. And in this instance, it's the percent reduction requirements of water production compared to 2013. And so we tiered those out to all add up to 25%, and we had 8 tiers based on our residential per capita use data. So those with lower per capita use had a lower percent reduction requirement. So those with the higher per capita use tend to be in the inland areas with big yards and high evapotranspiration. So they're having a harder time meeting their higher percentage reductions. And the bulk of the energy is how do we tweak those targets so they're not as stringent and expose folks to enforcement action.
Yes.
So thank you, Mr. Moore, for your warm welcome and for all the good information. It was a very thorough report. I just have one comment and a question. I wanted to commend you and your staff for the job you've been doing in getting the SURF funding out. I think you've really streamlined the application process, and people on staff have been extremely responsive. You've opened it up to a new group of people, as you stated, with your 40% increase, and I think that's tremendously valuable to getting monies encumbered and out and working in the community. So I'd like to, if you pass it on to staff, I think that's great. I think you've done a great job. And then I had a question on the AB401 water rate assistance staff, and if you could expand on that a little bit in terms of where they're distributed and what sort of services they're providing to disadvantaged communities and economically distressed areas and so on.
Yeah, and I wish I knew a little more in detail about it. I do remember the signing message of the governor. This was in October for AB 401. And the governor, I was inspired that he would go to this level of detail, just to explain how Prop 218 was really an impediment to things like conservation pricing. And you know, we talked about stormwater and flood control having an undue burden to get rate increases. But he pointed out, you know, just having a lifeline rate system for water, you know, and thinking about the human right to water being really critical to our state and our sustainability. So he made a point of highlighting that, and that he wanted to have his agencies really work on figuring out how to structure rates for low-income communities or households. And take a page out of the energy book, you know, where, you know, for electricity and gas, folks can get lifeline rates, and we don't have that in the water sector. So that's sort of the general, and then specifically, we were given a position and some contract funding from the waste discharge permit plan to develop the plan for funding and implementation of this program. So we have a person whose job it will be to say, okay, here's what's needed for the State Water Board, to engage in this this enterprise of really guiding, helping, working with local communities to help them sell to their elected boards, this type of a structured program. So it's a new area for us, and we're working with the Department of Water Resources and their conservation program and their expertise, sort of as a team. But we were given this position, which gets us a seat at the table. And the Water Board Forum has kind of proven itself to the environmental justice community and others as a more favorable place to get their concerns and heard and listened to and have programs adjusted than in the Department of Water Resources. It's just the way it's evolved. So this is a way for us to have somebody whose job it is to really engage in this.
Ms. Gray, I'd be happy to have staff reach out to the staff people in State Board that are actually recruiting for and filling the position and find out a little bit more detail about what that position will do if you would like.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Mr. Young.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. A couple questions, Mr. Moore, and thank you for your, as always, comprehensive and thorough reporting.
It just goes on and on and on.
Well, there's a lot to report on. I've got two questions. The first one has to do with the budget process. And so you mentioned both, well, certainly the Department of Finance, and then you might have mentioned Cal EPA, but I'm curious as to where our challenge is at, in this process of trying to shake loose more PYs for some of our programs. Should our effort be focused on Cal EPA, or is it the Department of Finance that really is the gatekeeper here?
I think we do best when we give the full budget picture of what we're asking for, and by that I mean, where will the funding come from? What fee payers will be available to create revenue to support the staff and the contract money? We'll try to parlay and leverage, what we do have to work with the federal government to get more resources to work, to make a case for general fund because of a statewide emergency, which we did for the cannabis cultivation issue, which was another item where there are 35 positions. And that will affect this region. It's not as acute here, but it is here. So we're able to get general funds for short-term kind of, emergency type issues, but we need to articulate in the long term, what entities out there could pay fees to support staff resources, because, as we've talked about, the legislature has said we're a fee-supported agency, and, the polluter pays idea, to be crass, but just the idea that, or the beneficiary pays. So figuring out a sustainable financing structure for our staff is key to making the case.
And is the pitch made to Cal EPA or to the Department of Finance?
There is kind of a hierarchy, and we start through Cal EPA. We some things get taken off the table, and then then Cal EPA takes all of the six agencies' proposals to the governor's office, and the Department of Finance plays the role of controller.
And is this pitch to Cal EPA made by the five state board members or just Mr. Howard?
No, Mr. Howard is our representative, and then Mr. Burns, the undersecretary.
Okay. Yeah. And then my second question has to go back to the
sometimes our chair gets involved too.
The chair too?
Yeah.
Okay. The Five River Systems and the public trust resource issues, and the minimum flow requirements. Is this going to be a series of State Water Board workshops to look at minimum flow requirements?
Excuse me, sorry. These have been If you read the action plan, you know, there's a paragraph there about minimum in-stream flows and the direction to the Department of Fish and Wildlife to work with the State Water Board to develop minimum in-stream flow recommendations for five rivers. And so, you know, the departments got together and prioritized and selected the ones a year ago. So it has been in different levels of advancement based on existing activities that we're doing. So we have emergency regulations in the Russian River up in North Coast, as well as in the Central Valley, Sacramento tributaries. So we're using those forums to engage stakeholders to talk about long-term in-stream flows per the action plan. And so that's one example. In the case of Ventura, we just we're initiating the process in December. So it's at a staff level, but then, you know, as with most of our program, as you know, the idea is that we get our internal vision together, work with our fellow state agencies, and then engage the stakeholders soon thereafter.
So this envisions some type of regulations being promulgated by the Water Board with in coordination with Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, yeah, and the Division of Water Rights in our State Water Board, right, and the local regional board.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. But it yep. is, I mean, it is, it's cutting edge. It's out of the action plan of the administration. So there's no law that says we have to do it, and yet we have the ability to establish water quality objectives for flow in our basin plans and in the statewide type regulation or plan.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you, and thank you for your very thorough report. I really do rely on the updates that you bring to us because it shows us the opportunities we have as a board to think about how those priorities at state present opportunities for us to move on our own issues. So I'm interested in oil and gas and some of the action going on now. You mentioned well stimulation areas. Am I correct in assuming that means fracking?
Yeah, it's hydraulic fracturing, but it's also acid stimulation in other ways, yeah, that the formation is changed to enable more extraction of resource.
Right, and so I just wanted to make sure everyone is understanding how the terminology is, you know, developing and emerging out of this new type of activity in our area. So Dogger, my understanding is Dogger is the lead and the initial agency under which these particular locations that are being considered for hydraulic fracking in particular. They're the lead agency, but just so I'm clear, the regions where these activities are starting to emerge, we will have a role in terms of permitting waste discharge. Is that correct?
Yeah, you do now, and there's a growing enhanced relationship, you know, in terms of, and then the MOU's been updated, so the expectations of interagency coordination are more specific. I would encourage you to have John Robertson of your staff brief you on the latest, you know, mm-hmm. of that dynamic area.
No, that's encouraging to know because I think we haven't had that close a relationship with Dogger even across the state, and especially considering where hydraulic fracking has been going on for decades. You know, so there's some grandfathered considerations that are perhaps not going to be moving forward into the new areas.
Yeah, we learned a lot in the last year with the workshops we had, and Lawrence Livermore folks, Lawrence Berkeley Labs, and USGS provide some data and analysis that gave us a lot better picture of the issues. You know, it's like some of the other issues you mentioned. We didn't have a lot of information. Now that we have more information, we can really make better, more precise decisions. Mm-hmm. And so we learned a lot. We learned that there are some drinking water aquifers that are in proximity of these operations where, you know, the prevailing opinion had been, oh, there's a big separation. You don't need to worry about it. And we hadn't seen any big signals of drinking water contamination. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with more investigation, we've learned that there's nuance, as always, with water issues.
Yeah. Well, good to hear. Thank you. And I will look forward to it. I'm sure at some point staff will be ready to come forward with a report.
Yeah, in fact, I'm glad, because I was going to say supplement a little bit about the local exemption being the first one.
Okay.
Food dogger.
So John Robertson, Regional Board staff, supervisor to the groundwater protection section. Responding first to Chair Wolf's point regarding aquifer exemption. The Arroyo Grande aquifer exemption is still in play, proceeding. We've commented on it. Mr. Moore made reference to a combined meeting between Dogger and the State Board, a public meeting here in town. The most recent update I have is I've seen a draft letter that is co-authored by State Board and Dogger that is in process, well beheaded to US EPA on the Arroyo Grande aquifer exemption. I don't have a sense of timing. I had a conference call on it about a week ago. Mm-hmm. But it's near, I think, you know, month-ish. Mm-hmm. Just a point of clarification, the State Board is mentioned in the MOA, in the MOU with Dogger, and their concurrence is necessary. The Regional Board is not, their concurrence is not necessary. There's just a point of clarification there. State Board would never, not to speak for them, but they would never act without consulting the regional boards. I can't imagine a scenario by which they would do that. There's so much benefit from that. That's all I got.
Could you define what an exemption or the whole...
The concept.
Yeah, just, yeah. I mean, for those in the audience.
That's a great question.
Kind of jargony.
Yeah, so it's a multi-layer thing. So, and just by way of background, oil companies produce a lot of water, far more water than they produce oil. A great oil field is on a ratio of about 8 parts water to 1 part oil. That's a great efficiency for an oil field. So they have to figure out what to do with the water. One of the strategies is they re-inject it. They have to have a place to discharge that water to, and that's where the aquifer exemption comes into existence. That's an exempted aquifer, from federal safe drinking water standards. That's the mechanism. Dogger is a primacy agency with concurrence from the State Water Board. So any application going forward from Dogger has to have concurrence from the State Water Board to US EPA. And what that effectively does is it allows injection into a specific three-dimensional zone. That is a vertical and lateral component to that, such that the effects of that injection will not be felt outside that zone, like a contained zone, you know, a containment zone. So after the aquifer exemption is approved, there are underground injection control projects, or you've heard the term UIC, again, a reference to federal regulation. And these are the actual injection sites, the wells that will be injected to. Those are also vetted through Dogger State Board and the Regional Board. So it's a multi-layered process of approval. First, there's the exemption process, and then there's the actual project level underground injection control wells that are approved. I also wanted to come back to hydraulic fracturing and stimulation. We don't have an abundance of that in our region. It just doesn't work with the geology. Oil companies would do it if it were beneficial, and it's hugely beneficial to extending the life of oil fields in the Central Valley. Strategically, it hasn't panned out in the Central Coast region. I think we've found 2 wells in the Central Coast region that have been hydraulically fractured out of the thousands and thousands and thousands of wells that are in production.
Yeah, it's my understanding, though, that there has been exploration in San Ardo, the San Ardo fields, and there is interest in southern Monterey County areas. And I think my understanding is the industry is just standing back and waiting to see what new regulations might look like.
Right.
And so my expectation is that given the geologic challenges, when the price of oil goes up,
comes back up,
there will be a reason to start looking at these areas,
yeah,
which are anticipated to be oil rich, but which present a higher technological investment,
right,
and a lot of new technology coming,
right,
online. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. So that's where I'm at.
Great, great comment, too. I don't want my comments to be construed as that's the end of the story. They will never hydraulically fracture in the Central Coast. We didn't know hydraulic fracturing would be an effective strategy for the Central Valley oil fields until the 80s. You know, we thought they were in decline and we were past their max yields. With hydraulic fracturing, they've boosted those yields and they're kind of having a second life in the Central Valley. So there could be a time and a scenario when the strategy is effective. You know, they evolve their strategies through time, oil companies do. And I also want to make note that what we call fracking or hydraulic fracturing is just one of the well stimulation activities that they use. They inject steam to decrease the viscosity of oil and increase the yield of the field. They use acid, you use the term, and I lost it there. Acid, it's essentially acid injection to clean out clays that are clogging the formations. And that's another technique that, you know, well stimulation technique that is used. And I think all of those, or at least those last two, fracking and acid injection, fall under SB4 regulation. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
One last thing. I'm going to a teaser here. And I've talked to you, Dr. Hunter, about this in the past. We plan a staff report on the comprehensive discussion of what active oil field regulation is in the, I'm looking over at Aaron, one of our oil field staff, in the March board meeting in Santa Barbara. So stay tuned.
And also, we're looking at potentially a field trip for board members this year.
Yes,
that's also
in the spring.
In the pipeline.
To the San Ardo oil field. I've had discussions with Chevron about this. And so it'll be a subgroup of the board that
exactly
will be taken, and potentially state board members, too. I've had some discussion with some.
Yeah, we got the Delta thing we got to do.
All right, thank you. Ms. Cervantes?
I just wanted to ask a quick question about the lifeline water rates that you were discussing previously. And it's my understanding with the initiative that is sponsored by the League of Cities and a number of other folks throughout the state that those lifeline water rates are only an option for agencies if we are successful in passing the November ballot that includes reforms to Prop 218.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That is correct. This becomes a tool, you know, this has been an argument for folks that we haven't had the tool in the toolbox. We haven't had the authority to even do the things we want to do. So now the tool becomes available. The entity still has to take the tool out of the toolbox and do the work to make it legal. And that would go for stormwater fees too, you know, just because the ability to raise stormwater fees to do utility work is there. It doesn't mean the agencies are going to raise fees, you know, unless they can make a case.
Right. I know we're behind that effort as a local municipality, just because it also allows us not just the stormwater regulations and some of the fees that we're able to collect for some of those infrastructure improvements, but also around flood control,
mm-hmm,
which is also currently not an option for us as a city to be able to go through that process. The other question that I had on your stormwater strategy discussion, I think I share your excitement when you're talking about some of the alternative pathways for compliance. And when are those regulations going to be available for folks that might not currently be meeting compliance?
Yes, great question. The there's kind of a multi-layer answer to that. Within the stormwater strategy itself and the work plan that it is, it's basically a work plan for our staff state and then and somewhat regional level. And within that, this is a phase one, the alternative compliance work and reasonable assurance analysis that we talk about, you know, is embedded within that. That's a high priority item in the strategy. So it's envisioned that we'll have guidelines on that in the next year or year and a half. I'll have to check, you know, but it's in the strategy as far as proposed timelines for work products out of our strategy. There's that layer. But then also I would encourage you, if you want to leap ahead kind of thing, that, you know, the Los Angeles Regional Water Board is really cutting their teeth on this issue. And I know, I'm sure Dominic's tied into that work from Renee Purdy and other folks there about how do you evaluate a watershed management plan and its reasonable assurance analysis and whether there's milestones there that are enforceable to hold folks to account to get certain things done and certain capital plans, you know, developed and then ultimately, you know, proposed and implemented. So, you know, and then what are the technical details of that analysis? So they're doing work, San Diego, San Francisco Bay boards. So there's already a round table discussion, if you will, of the regional boards on how you get this type of thing set up.
Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. Thank you, Mr. Moore, for the report. I do appreciate the level of detail. There's no need to apologize for it. And in fact, I confess that at times after the audio of these meetings is posted online, I have gone back and re-listened to your report because it can be a little dense, but there's a lot in there.
No reflection on your personality.
Dense can be a good thing.
I'm at 4 degrees Celsius, the densest water can be, yeah.
What are the five rivers? The Ventura and the other, what are the other four?
It's Marquette Creek, which is a tributary of the Russian River, pretty big creek. Mill Creek, which is an relatively undammed tributary of the Sacramento River up in Tehama County, with a significant run of native Chinook, so Marquette, Mill, Shasta River, Klamath tributary. Yeah, I said Ventura River. Oh man, what's the fifth one? So, South Fork of the Eel River. So yeah, your buddies in the North Coast got the bulk of it, but they have a lot of water, you know, up there. And
for now,
and so they can sort of, you know, come up with the. It's easier when you can measure water to come up with criteria. Sorry, I don't mean to make light of it. But those are some significant resources. Fish and Wildlife weighed in on that, but we're excited because we think this will be a template that, you know, we can really move forward with. It's a necessary element of our long-term sustainable water management.
Thank you. And just a brief comment on some of the questions that some of my fellow board members raised about the stipend question. I ducked out of the last fall's a water quality coordinating committee meeting in Sacramento to go meet with someone in the governor's office and essentially to push the concept that there ought to be, I guess my concept was they ought to set aside some money so that in each region there could be a couple of board members that on an income basis, on a need basis, could have a higher stipend, because I've just heard repeatedly over the years the desire to have more both ethnic and economic diversity on these boards, and it's a real problem when, you know, we have to essentially, you know, clear our calendars for a dozen or more days a year. An awful lot of people are not in positions that can do that. You know, they're not retired, they're not attorneys, they're not employed in a situation that allows that flexibility or have bosses that will allow that. And I got a couple of interesting responses. One was that the Coastal Commission pays now a $500 a day stipend to all the board members. And I mean, of course, there's a huge range of governor appointees from fair boards to yourself, Mr. Moore, you know, to which is a full-time position, or the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, something like that, full-time positions, ranging from zero compensation to, you know, all across the board. And the response I got was, first of all, the last time this was brought up, which got a very negative response from the governor's office, we were in a real deficit situation in the budget. Now we're not. And, you know, the sense was that that there would be quite a bit more openness to it at this point, and that it probably made more sense to do it on a broader scale than something as complicated as trying to do an income-based exception for some board members. When I took that input back to a state board staff at the WQCC, I think that was some of the impetus for moving this. So, there's not really a yardstick. The answer I got, is completely all over the map. And it's would be very difficult to do a one size fits all because, you know, the Board of Cosmetology has one level of commitment and, you know, the State Water Board has a different level. Hopefully that's somewhat informative.
That's good. I'm hoping, you know, this will be up to the regional boards to some extent, you know, but the state board, you know, our executive director and our division of administrative services, you know, with John Russell, to find some sort of, where's the flexibility in this? You know, there'll be the 500 compensation, but then there's a budget, and then is there some level of discretion for certain board members who may travel and participate in certain things, you know, and that would qualify as a day that can be compensated. It will be $500, but, you know, is that enough flex in the system within the budget, you know, for the regional boards to operate in those ways? Because we really value board members being out in the community, participating, getting input, and it makes us all more efficient in our programs in the long run. So,
and it would make it much, much easier for the government's appointment office to recruit more broadly for these boards. That's just a fact of life. You're not gonna get farm workers on this board if they have to take time off of work.
Yeah, so I'm hoping this with a larger pot, hopefully we'll come up with some creative solutions working together. But those goals were certainly at the heart of these changes to really encourage diversity and representativeness. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It is 10 to 11. I'd like us to take a 15-minute break and meet again at 5 past 11. Thank you very much.